Welcome back to After the Buzzer. I am Gordy Jones, and joining me from actually just around the corner, but he is on assignment, is that Mike Gross. Hello, Mike.
Hi, Gordy. Sitting in my car.
As always, sports writing is a glamorous profession.
Yeah. This is a good example of that. Yeah.
And our guest this week is Millersville baseball coach John Sheehan. John is a Lampeter Strasburg and MU grad. He has just completed his 15th year there at MU. He's won over 500 games, including 42 this year. The Marauders on his watch have won two PSAC titles, 9 PSAC East titles. They made 10 NCAA appearances, including this year, and they also won a PSAC title this year, I should add. And over the course of his 15 years there, they have had 10 draftees, the most notable of which are Chas McCormick, who's an outfielder for the Astros currently, and left-handed pitcher Tim Mayza, who's with Toronto, and also Tyler Yankowski, is a right-handed pitcher in the Nat system. So, long introduction, John, but welcome.
Thanks, Gordy. Thanks, Mike. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for all you guys do for especially amateur sports in our region. It's awesome to have the coverage that you guys provide.
Well, we're glad to have you, John. And I just, obviously your season didn't quite end the way you would have hoped. And I wonder, what do you do in the wake of a season that you had those losses to East Strasburg and Charleston? Do you just flush those, or do you kind of, nitpick at them and say, I could have done this differently, I could have done that differently? How do you look at it when a season ends, not quite as you might have hoped?
Sure. I don't know that we've even had time. We got our end of the season meetings done, and we went recruiting. We've had multiple transfers in the office this week already, and the transfer portal's hot. We try not to recruit majority of our squad from the transfer portal, but there's a huge number of kids in there. Obviously, I'm sure you guys have heard. So we're trying to take advantage and fill a couple holes here before it's too late, and then we'll probably go back and watch a video of the last couple of weeks and try to assess what we can do better in the fall.
John, I would not watch that video of Saturday if I was you. That was a long day, my man.
It was. Well, maybe we'll watch it on time and a half and shorten it, but
yeah. There you go.
It's hard to learn walking guys, but it is. Yeah. It's hard to learn from walking guys, but at the same time, there are some things that we could definitely pick up and improve on. Obviously.
Sure. Yeah. And we should point out that you won 40. You were 42-14 and won the PSAC. So it's not like this is a negative story, of course. But the last day was a long one, a long hot one, the hottest day of the year so far.
Yes, it was. We had a number of guys come in and say, we lost 15 pounds, 20 pounds, But I had a feeling that once, whoever won that first game was going to be in the driver's seat. And then whoever lost the first game was probably going to lose the second one just because of the, and not to make excuses, but it was just a tough game.
Sure, yeah.
So,
John, I was interested to hear you say that the transfer portal has become a big deal. It has always seemed to me in PSAC sports like there's been a fair number of transfers, but what's changed recently in that sort of a realm?
I think it's interesting because before you could transfer from D1 to D2 and not have to sit a year. So, we actually had we had the market kind of cornered there where we If a kid would leave a Power 5 school and he'd want to play right away, especially kids that were draft eligible and thought they had a shot to get drafted, they would come to D2 schools or junior colleges if they had a year of junior college eligibility. So now they can transfer from D2 to D1 and not sit a year. They can transfer from D1 to D1 and sit a year. So it's created an opportunity for kids. As frustrating as it is for coaches, it's created a giant opportunity for kids to jump around and find the right fit, even after they may have chosen the wrong school to begin with. It's made things really interesting. There's a lot of PSAC kids trying to go to Division I, which some of them definitely fit. And there's a lot of kids that are at Division One who may not get playing time who think that the PSAC or other D2s might be a good fit. So there's just a lot more kids there now. And I think when you throw in the rules and COVID, it's exploded.
John, I happen to see that you were at Tech Ed. Your degree is in Tech Ed. I was wondering, have you always been geared toward coaching, or was this something that you kind of evolved around to?
That's a great question, Gordy. You know, Todd Garber, he's actually my neighbor now, but he's always been my mentor.
Mm-hmm.
He's done obviously a fantastic job in the softball world.
Right.
And has definitely had a hand in that Lampier-Strasburg program since he left the Lampier-Strasburg baseball program. But I was always interested in the coaching world, but I thought it would be at the high school level.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got done playing professionally, it was probably the right decision. It worked out in the long run, but to hang them up. And a graduate assistant position opened at Millersville, mm-hmm. and I got in the athletic department there, so thinking I'd still maybe go back to teaching high school and coaching at that level.
Right.
And then Jeff Swore was the head coach at the time, and he resigned. And
mm-hmm.
I remember our vice president of student affairs walked in right before Peg Kaufman was hired officially as the athletic director, Rich Ferrix, and he said, "Hey, you're our interim head coach. Good luck."
Nice.
Okay, so the profession chose me. I mean, that's just kind of the way it worked out. But I've been here ever since.
What was the transition like for you?
At 25, it was downright scary. Joe Traynor was the head football coach.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I walked in his office and I said, "Joe, what am I supposed to do? I'm 25. I'm a head coach. I'm barely older than anybody, you know, the seniors on the team." And he said, "You're never ready. If you got this job when you're 40, it wouldn't matter. You wouldn't be ready. You just have to jump in and do the job."
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I referred to it. I'm on a cohort with a bunch of D1 guys, and they bust my chops because I'm always talking about, you know, we throw a lot of crap at the wall, and some of it sticks and some of it doesn't. But I've never felt like at Millersville I've had job security issues.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just enabled me to be innovative and try things. And when they don't work out, you move on to the next thing. And we've kind of been doing that ever since. And we're still here and we're still trying to be innovative.
That's great.
John, another person who I remember you telling me you considered to be a mentor, and she is one of my all-time favorites, now retired, Mary Fleed, the women's basketball coach there. What did she do for you? What did she let you – what did you learn from her, I guess?
First of all, I'm going to toot her horn as well. She is someone I would consider one of my best friends. She took me under her wing, and we went to lunch. Her and her staff and our young staff went to lunch probably 3 or 4 times a week the first 2 years I was there. We'd go over to cross gates and we'd hit balls. And she, at the time, the athletic department was on probation and we were going through a major transition period.
She was
the only one that was super successful. Yeah. So I just want to surround myself with successful people and figure out how she did it. Her words of wisdom were pretty simple though: fundraise your butt off and recruit like crazy. And I can honestly say that's what our program foundation is. It's recruiting good people and fundraising a ton.
Hmm. And you
go ahead, Gordy.
You mentioned your career. As our listeners should know, that you were a .328 career hitter as a catcher at Millersville, and you spent 2 years in the deep minors in the Braves organization. Well, what did you take away from that experience?
Oh man, JJ Piccolo was the scout that signed me. I was the last player that he signed before he went to the front office of the Braves. Now, JJ's actually the GM of the Royals.
Okay.
So I was really fortunate to be around people that knew how to build a great organization. Mm. And even with the turmoil that was going on at Millersville, I felt like that was the start for me to, you know, learning how to build a good culture.
Mm-hmm.
JJ and Dayton was our farm director. He's now the president of the Royals.
Mm-hmm.
They were really good at making the peon bullpen catcher in the lower levels of the minor league feel like I was actually making a difference in the system. You know, that takes it, you know, it's pretty hard. It takes some gifted people to make you feel that way when you're catching once a week when the sun's out and it's 95 degrees on Sunday, you know. But great people. We wore the uniform the right way. We had to shave every day. It wasn't militaristic, but it was very disciplined in the lower levels in the minor leagues. I would credit those guys. I mean, they did a phenomenal job with player development, and that's why we're in the midst of winning those 13 division titles at that point.
John, I would think it's hard to recruit for baseball. I'd say that's just a – tell me how you can tell – what are you looking for when you go to high school games or you go to showcases or whatever? How can you tell? How can you tell that a guy's got it? And particularly, I would think with hitters, it would be difficult. Tell us about recruiting.
I'll tackle the hitting question. I love that question. Brent Taylor is a guy for us that hit 425. He had some pretty gaudy numbers last 2 years. Last year, he was the player of the year in the conference, and this year, he may have been player of the year, but Caulfield transferred in and stole the title from him. So, but when I went to see Brand, his high school coach actually called and said, man, we got a kid who hit 600 and he struck out once. And those bat-to-ball skills, the ability to make contact for a hitter is the hardest thing to measure. So you got to go out and watch players. I mean, that's the hardest part about it, especially hitters, is you need to go out and watch them hit. And we've tried to not sign high school, in particular, position players that we don't see 20 to 25 at bats. We've just missed on too many kids. So we want to see them on good days and bad days, but hard contact is the best way to measure a hitter's ability. And I feel like we can clean up a lot of the swing and the approach, but it's really hard to teach a kid to hit that constantly swings and misses. So. But pitching wise, it's a lot easier. I mean, you can tell if a kid's missing barrels and he throws strikes, and his numbers are going to back that up. If he's got a high swing and miss rate, high strikeout numbers, and low walks in high school, he usually has good stuff. And then you got to go out and watch them pitch as well. But I just think college coaches now, the showcases and the events and the video. Most guys take the easy route and it requires putting the time in.
Yeah, right. That makes sense. Let's talk a little bit about this incredibly cool thing that happened this year where you had a major league hitter versus pitcher matchup that was Millersville against Millersville. Tell us about how that felt, and it's just one little moment, but sort of a stamp of approval for what you're doing.
Those two guys making it, I'll start with that. Being at Tim's debut was a highlight, not just of my career, but my life. I mean, just seeing a kid's dreams come true, it's an incredible moment. I kicked myself. I actually was quarantined when Chaz's debut happened. I was at home, and I wasn't allowed to go anywhere, so I had to watch it from TV. But definitely emotional. Emotional time, but you know, seeing those kids be able to play in the big leagues. Facing each other was, you know, they actually had two or three points last year where Chaz was on deck, and one of them I was in the stands for. I drove to Buffalo after the season was over. Toronto was playing Houston in Buffalo last year, and Chaz was on deck, but I got to go to dinner with both of those guys after the game. That was pretty cool. But the baseball that Chaz teed, you know, squared him up pretty good in their first round, and he grabbed the baseball for me, and they both signed it and had it authenticated, and they sent it to Millersville. So that was a pretty cool thing.
That's a really cool thing. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'll cherish that one forever. For sure.
Understandable, John. I was just talking. I'm in Mannheim Township getting ready to cover this game, and I was just talking to Matt Kirchhoff, the coach here, and he said he was talking about how good he thinks our league is, and if you could talk a little bit about the Lancaster 11 in league, and you and I have talked about this before, but the Lancaster 11 in league and this area as a recruiting ground for you?
I think that's where it starts. I mean, one of the reasons why Millersville and Westchester have been the only two schools to win the PSAC East for the last, I want to say it's been 14 or 15 years, is that,
wow,
yeah, it's crazy to think about that, but is the recruiting area that we're in. There is phenomenal baseball in this area, and the Lancaster Lebanon Lake has been a breeding ground for our program. I could go back, like I said, 15 years, we've had someone from the Lancaster Lebanon Lake that's been successful every year on the team. And it's interesting, it's not just the powerhouse programs either. I mean, we pulled the Stoltzfus brothers from Peckway Valley, and that was the one year they won the Lancaster Lebanon League championship.
Yeah.
You don't have to go far. Sometimes keeping them at home is more of the challenge than finding the talent. Just like me, though, Lancaster County kids, some of them just don't leave. Our goal is to try to get the best kids from Lancaster 11 League every year. It's been a challenge at times, but it's nice to be able to jump in your car and go 20 minutes to a local high school rather than some of our opponents who have to drive 3 or 4 hours to see a good high school game.
Well, your alma mater, LS, has been a big part of what the LL League has been about. I wonder if you could just address, you know, why that program has been so successful over these last several years.
Sure. I think it starts with the team that I watched when I was a sixth grader in Williamsport win that first state title in 1994.
Mm-hmm.
They set the tone. I grew up around some of those guys, got to know Rob Berger pretty well. Mm-hmm. As I got older, I was catching him when he'd come home from pro ball.
Mm-hmm.
And that winning tradition was just started by Hank.
Yeah.
It was carried on by Garb and Coach Martin and now Coach Swore. I mean, they know how to win, and I think having the expectation to win and a youth program that's proud of the high school and the heritage too is so important to continued success at the high school level.
Yeah. Hank is one of my all-time favorite people, and here's my enduring memory of Hank. I was covering a game down there. I think it might have been against Donegal, and they had the infield in, and somebody hit a ground ball, I think, to the second baseman, and the guy threw the ball halfway up the backstop, and I can still hear Hank's anguished cry from the dugout. I don't know why that's given how many games he won, I don't know why that's an enduring memory, but it is.
I'll tell you, he was the head varsity coach when I was a freshman, and I had Garber as a sophomore. Hank scared the daylight out of me. Catch the ball, Sean. You know, and he was tough, but just, you know, extremely old school. Kids still really liked him, though. We were scared of him, but we all really liked him and we respected the heck out of him.
Yeah, I could see that. I could see him walking. I really liked the guy. I just thought he was just a real good baseball guy for sure.
He was actually a basketball coach too, right?
Yeah.
Yes, he was.
Yeah.
Yes, he was.
Yeah. And by the
surprisingly witty. He had some witty comments. You had to listen close for them, but he would sneak in some humor every once in a while between his yelling.
Yeah.
So
amid the yelling.
Yes. Well.
Okay, John, how's it look? How's your program look going forward? I mean, just in terms of what's coming back and where you feel like you are.
Sure. Well, Alex Mikett was probably a top 15 round pick until he tore his UCL in 2021. So we were on the verge of getting him back. He would probably have been ready this weekend or next. So that was a big loss for us. But he'll be back. He has 2 years eligibility, assuming he doesn't get drafted this summer. And that's really the big challenge for us right now is that they moved the draft back, and it's now the end of July, and there's only 20 rounds. So we're trying to navigate this new place that Division II is with the transfer portal and the draft being later. And, you know, whether Bren Taylor and Thomas Caulfield gets picked, you know, that's a big factor in how well we play next year. But we do feel like we're going to be way better on the mound, a lot deeper on the mound than we were this year. Ben Lchacki's back. He's got 2 more years eligibility. along with Mike, Colby Gromlich was supposed to be our number two this year, and he was actually sick for a lot of the year. So he'll be back and hopefully healthy. So we're really looking forward to it. We're hoping to either get one transfer position player, an infielder or an outfielder, and then a couple transfer arms would be helpful as well. But team's going to be deep. We only graduated five seniors.
Tell us a little bit about Caulfield. How did he land here? And we're talking about a guy who was, the NCAA Regional Athlete of the Year, right? And sort of a power shortstop kind of guy. Tell us about him.
It's definitely a Power 5 talent, and you don't get that very often in the PSAC. I mean, you got a lot of Division 1 caliber kids, but, man, it's a lot of fun to watch kids that have that kind of ability, and it's just not the norm. But he was at UNC, Chapel Hill, his freshman year. It didn't work out. He ended up at Pitt Community College, had a very good run there, and then left there and went to UNC Charlotte, and COVID hit, and they brought in a bunch of transfers on top of him, and he didn't get an opportunity there again, which was obviously a mistake. He went to the Coastal Plains League last summer, which is a high-power, mostly Division I league in the Carolinas, and he hit 13 home runs and had a really good summer. And we were just fortunate enough to get him. He knew he had a track record with player development, getting kids drafted, and we had a mutual contact from his old high school summer ball days, Mike Manning, who actually sent us a kid named Chris Murphy years ago from TCU as well. So anytime Mike calls now with a transfer, I answer.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, Chris went on to be 34-3, I believe, in 3 years at Millersville. So just an incredible career. But Thomas, he's got a little bit of swing and miss. He had 52 strikeouts this year, but the kid could flat out hit. He had 16 home runs. He set our single season home run record. He drove in over 70 runs, a bunch of doubles as well. And he's a fantastic kid, great leader, well-spoken young man. And I hope he gets a chance in July. We'd be glad to have him back as well. But he I believe he certainly deserves to play professional baseball.
Let's talk a little bit about the commitment, the year-round commitment. What is your guys' year-round calendar like? Because, it's more than just, the spring. We think of it as a spring sport. I know the answer to this for football, and so do a lot of people, but for baseball, what's the year-round calendar like?
Sure. So I'll start in the fall. Our guys get back the third week of August, and we'll start workouts that week. We've got about a week of what we call individuals. They're in the weight room three or four times that week, and we're kind of setting the pace for the year at that point. Just kind of teaching the guys how we go about our business in all facets. And then we'll go into our in-season period. We'll have a 45-day in-season period in the fall. It's 15 hours a week. Most of these kids spend a lot more time on their own than 15 hours. I've been really fortunate to be able to coach kids that are super passionate about baseball, and I think it's rubbed off on class to class, but these guys grind it out. They're at the field from, 1 to 5, 5:30 every day. We've got a couple weight sessions sprinkled in during the week, and then about October 15th to the 20th, we'll move on to our off-season phase, which they're in the weight room 4 days a week in the morning. And then they have 4 short individual workouts in the afternoon. And they'll have 3 days off at that point during the week. But that leads up to Christmas. And then January 12th is when they'll come back about 10 days earlier than the regular student population. And we'll have a 10-day training period where it's like 8 in the morning till 10 at night. It's kind of like football camp. It's meetings and team building and two-a-days. And then what catches most people off guard, Jens, is that we start games the first weekend in February every year.
Wow.
And we'll roll.
Yeah, I thought that was our case. Yeah, I thought February was when you started. Yeah.
So most people are like, wait, you guys are playing baseball? They look outside and they see 20 inches of snow on the ground sometimes. And we make 3 trips down to the Carolinas in February each year.
Nice. Well, where do you train in January on campus?
We are either on our field, if there's no snow on it, and the last few years it's been pretty good from a temperature aspect. And then, considering it's January, maybe in the 40s, we'll train at Keystone in Mannheim.
Okay.
And then,
and
then we have a couple cages at the Student Memorial Center on campus as well.
Okay, that's interesting to me. But I think maybe it gets a little lost about just how intensive the training is, you know, how it is a kind of a year-round thing for college players.
Yeah, you know, the one thing I did mention is summer ball. So our guys have been off for about a week now, and we have 24 kids that are playing in college summer leagues all the way from Colorado to the Cape Cod this summer. So Caulfield got a contract with the Chatham Anglers on Cape Cod. So he'll be up there, and then we have three kids going to Colorado as well. And most of those guys will play an additional 40 to 50 game schedule in the summer. So
it's
a lot of baseball.
Over 100 games a year,
That Cape Cod League is one of the most respected and storied leagues in baseball, right?
Yeah, we've had actually I was counting today, we've had eight kids play up there. Tommy will be the first position player.
Wow.
The other guys were all arms. So that's a pretty cool thing. Even Chaz didn't get a chance to play up there. It's just really, really tough to get in.
That's great. That's really a great thing. I mean, I just heard great things about that. It's something I've always wanted to go up and see because I've heard it's just a kind of a community feel, right? The teams are all kind of in small towns and such.
They're all small towns, high school fields. The games are free. And I'm hoping to take my boys up. They're 11 and 13. The last time we went to a Cape Cod League game, Tim Mazet was pitching there. I think they were 1-3. So 11 and 13 now. It's time to get back before it's too late. But if you guys have a chance to go, and I would anybody who listens to this podcast is a baseball fan, you're going to see some of the best baseball in the country played on high school fields for free. And it's just an incredible atmosphere.
And it's wooden bat too, right?
All wooden bat, yes. And on any given night, you can watch, you know, LSU's number one arm face off with Vanderbilt's number one arm, and there'll be 35 scouts and GMs sitting in the stands.
Wow. That's pretty great.
I
love it.
It's awesome.
John, we know you have a middle school concert to attend. We'll let you get out of here on this. I just want to ask you one more thing. Do you what are you thinking about in terms of your own future? Are you thrilled to be Millersville's baseball coach for the long haul, or if something else happens, would you be pursuing maybe Division I or whatever?
So my kids are at a great age. We're pretty locked into our community. We love being in Lancaster-Strasburg District. My wife teaches there now. Both my kids play for the Keystone Bombers and the local Lancaster-Strasburg rec program. So we're really locked in. I'm not really looking for anything, you know, and Millersville has been super supportive. Miles Gallagher, athletic director, actually played for me, so I've been really fortunate to have a great relationship with him. We've got some big things in the work at Cooper Park over the next 5 to 10 years as well, and got a vision for that. Our goal long term is to put lights up there and just start hosting a lot more community games, hopefully some LA Lake baseball, some District 3 baseball, maybe some PIAA stuff. And I don't know when it's going to happen, but that's a vision I have. And I just think that as good as we've been, we can get better. And it's still motivating to go to work every day, and I love making an impact on young men. So why would I go anywhere?
Well, might end up coaching your sons at some point. You never know.
I don't know about that. I struggle with that now. They don't want to listen to me right now, so I'm not sure how it would work in college. But you never know. You never know.
Yeah, they're not going to listen to you, John. That's
what it works. I'll tell you what. I hope they get a chance to maybe play for one of our old assistants. We got a guy up at Columbia. They just won the Ivy League title. Eric Suplee. He was our pitching coach at Millersville. And then our other pitching coach is now out at Air Force. So, the connections there, I think, I'm pushing those two kids. I'm like, you know, if you work hard enough and you do well enough in school, you can go to Columbia or Air Force. We have it in there. So
that's nice.
Nice.
Well, excellent.
John, thank you so much for joining us. And we wish you the best, and we hope to have you on again sometime. Keep up the good work.
It was a pleasure, guys.
All right, be well.
Thank you guys for covering local sports. We really appreciate it.
All right, take care. Be well, John. Take care.
Bye.
So, Mike, I it's interesting what John has been able to accomplish, really kind of built that program. I think it's always been pretty good, but I think he's kind of taken it to the next level given all he's accomplished. What's your takeaway from our conversation with John?
First of all, I had kind of forgotten that they were on probation when he got that job.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not a great situation, which is how you get a 25-year-old head coach at Division II. That's how that happens. And he turned it around pretty instantly. I mean, they were really bad 1 year, and then they won the PSAC East the next year, his first actual season as the coach, which was really on an interim basis. So I'm just really impressed. And the other thing is, at the time, the perception was, and even until fairly recently, that it's pretty hard to recruit at Millersville. Mm-hmm. But the fundraising piece and the number of scholarships that they made available was always sort of behind the top tier of their own conference, much less the country in Division II. So, the guy's done a remarkable job. There's no, it's almost like a well-kept secret a little bit, because obviously we don't cover this team constantly the way we do the high schools.
Right.
But man, it's impressive. Impressive what he's done.
Yeah, I had a whole sheet of paper with his accomplishments. He's the 3-time Atlantic Region Coach of the Year, 5-time PSAC East Coach of the Year. And in 2016, when Millersville went 53-7 and finished as the national runner-up, he was the Division II Coach of the Year. So this is a guy who's got a pretty sizable track record 15 years in.
Yeah, no doubt. And that ability, I think it's hard. I think it's got to be hard to recruit in baseball generally.
Yes.
And then to find kids who are the right fit for this level where you're serious Division II, it's amazing the job that he's done, really.
Yeah, the other challenge that I've heard about baseball in particular is retention, because there's a lot of midweek doubleheaders, there's a lot of away time, and obviously as he described, it's a pretty demanding schedule the entire school year. So that is the other challenge I think that college baseball coaches really have to square away.
That's a thing that I sort of didn't realize until I paid a little more attention to them this year, is how many midweek doubleheaders, as you just said, how many of those they play. A lot of it in the conference, big conference, like they'll play East Strasburg on a Wednesday in a doubleheader, and in addition to all the weekend stuff they do. So it's, man, you really got to love the game.
Yeah, it's true. Very true.
To do what those kids do, you really got. I was thinking about that. Watching them play on Saturday, as much of a grind as that day was, man, was that.
Oh yeah, I mean, you said it was a 7-hour day, correct?
It was a 7-hour day, and their pitching just fell apart at the end of the year.
Yeah.
It sounds like on paper they're going to be better and deeper next year, but they had a lot of injuries, and it ended up really costing them.
Mm-hmm. Here's a little side note. As we're always known for tangents on our podcast, their field is named after, his name is Ben Cooper. He was actually a teammate. He not only played baseball, he is a basketball teammate of Glenn Stitzel, whose son, Casey Stitzel, is now the head men's basketball. So there's your tangent. There's our first of many tangents, no doubt.
Well done, sir. Well played. I like it.
So just a couple degrees of separation there.
Yeah, I forgot that Glenn Stitzel was also a baseball player. I knew that, but I forgot.
Yeah. So we'll move on from there. We wanted to talk a little bit about the conference finals in the NBA, which right now find Boston up 3-2 over Miami after an incredibly ragged Miami performance in Game 5. And Golden State, as we sit here, they're poised to close out their series with a 3-1 lead over Dallas. So what stood out to you, Mike, about what's happened in these two series?
Well, the last time we spoke, we said, or I said, that it seems to me like the NBA is just baffled by Luka Doncic. Mm-hmm. Well, the Golden State Warriors are not baffled by Luka Doncic, and I thought the defensive job that they've done surprised me, and I was amused to hear a Jason Kidd quote today that they're playing so much zone because they know they can't guard us one-on-one. Well, they're trying to win, Jason, and you know what? They're trying to win. The team that has more points at the end advances, so
yeah.
I guess that was probably a little bit of gamesmanship.
Sure.
Attempt at gamesmanship on his part.
Yeah.
But you know, they haven't always played zone. They have played a lot of man-to-man, and they have a guy who is emerging as a very, very good player who can match up pretty well with Luka Doncic. And so that impresses me, what they've done defensively.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of one of the takeaways I have, that Andrew Wiggins, he was the first overall pick in 2014 by Minnesota, and the Warriors got him in a trade a couple years ago. They got him and the pick that became Jonathan Kuminga for D'Angelo Russell, which is the kind of trade that smart teams always seem to make, and on the other side, dumb teams always seem to make. Because
I would say that was a successful trade. They won that one.
I think they won that one pretty decisively, because Kuminga looks like he's going to be a really good player. And Wiggins, in his role as the third wheel or the fourth wheel or whatever you want to say, That seems to be a pretty ideal role for him, too, because he's kind of the first line of defense against Luka. And, you know, while Luka's had two 40-point games in this series, I think Wiggins has done a pretty commendable job while also doing his share of damage at the other end.
Yeah, Wiggins has been great. I would say this about the number of points that Luka is scoring.
Mm-hmm.
Everything they do offensively goes through him.
Mm-hmm.
And everything they do offensively comes from him.
Right.
So you can't. It's almost like it's not true to say it doesn't matter that he got 40.
Right.
But the efficiency with which they play offensively overall, he has a huge responsibility for that. So you have to judge him mm-hmm. based on that.
Right.
And based on that, they have done a great job on him.
Yeah. And you know, and the other thing at the other end, they do what they do. They play the beautiful game. They didn't have such a beautiful game in Game 4. Dallas got out by 29 after three quarters on the Warriors. And then both teams played their subs for an extended stretch in the fourth quarter, and the Warriors subs had much the better of it and got it to 8, actually, with like 3 minutes to play. So everybody's starters had to come back in. So as we discussed, you know, before this pod, that's kind of a win in a way for the Warriors that they only lost by 10 after getting outplayed so soundly for three quarters.
Yeah, I always believe in that. I always believe in fight your way through it to the extent that you can. I mean, you got to play the subs, of course. But
right.
It's a 30-point game. I think that sort of sends a message for the next game.
Yeah, agreed.
That's worth doing. Yeah, absolutely.
And the other thing that I was thinking about after this game was Wiggins is only 27, even though it seems like he's been around for 20 years. And Kayvon Looney, another guy, he's only 26. And then the Warriors have four other guys that are even younger than that in Kuminga, James Wiseman, Moses Moody, and Jordan Poole. They're kind of setting themselves up for the post-Curry, Thompson, Draymond era. And, you know, maybe not all those guys are still going to be on the team 3 or 4 years from now, but you at least have pieces that you can maybe get another, you know, bellwether guy. It's kind of an interesting thing to watch.
That's right. Some of those guys are not going to be there, I don't think, because I just don't think they can pay them all.
Right.
But they do have, you're right, they do have an opportunity to transition to the next phase. And I really like Looney. I think he's been really good. He's a really good passer.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's a really smart basketball player. I like the way he sort of thinks the game and approaches it, and he's got the rebounding gene,
right?
In extremis. So he's been terrific, I think.
Yeah, this is a surprise to me because I thought that the way Dallas plays with a lot of small ball, that they were going to play Looney right off the court, and that hasn't happened at all. He's held up okay defensively, and he's had some decent scoring games too. So he's really been a factor in this series, which really comes as a surprise to me.
Watching Dallas most of the year, I wasn't that crazy about their team except for Luka.
Right.
And then after what they did in the playoffs, and especially what they did to Phoenix, which, who knows, Phoenix is the enduring... If there's going to be a 30-for-30 about this basketball season down the road, it's going to be about the Phoenix Suns.
Yes.
And what the hell happened there.
Yes. But
anyway, Dallas now looks to me more like what I thought they were maybe in January, in terms of their supporting cast. But obviously so much of it is if the threes go in.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just the game right now. That's like putting in golf.
Yeah.
If the putts go in, if the threes go in, it erases a lot of flaws or mistakes or whatever.
Yeah. So, yeah, it would really, I hope at some point the reporting reveals what happened with Phoenix, because it certainly seems like more happened than meets the eye. I mean, Chris Paul... Maybe he was hurt, maybe he's just old, but he played poorly. And the whole team just seemed to completely fall apart at the end of their series against Dallas. And it almost signaled that something was going on internally. I mean, you mentioned this before we came on about, you know, DeAndre Ayton refused to go back into Game 7, which led to some tense moments with Monty Williams. So there's that piece, but it seemed like it went way beyond that, too.
Yeah, I think it... I mean, Ayton has a contract situation, which apparently is part of this story. The owner is a strange guy who has some skeletons, and who knows what impact that has, and maybe they're going to sell, maybe he's going to end up selling it. Mm-hmm. This is the kind of thing that you sort of speculate on when such a spectacular collapse happens. I mean, if it didn't happen, none of these things would even occur to us, but there has to be something going on there.
Yeah, it has to be. There has to be much more than meets the eye. And over on the other side, it just looks like Miami they've kind of run out of bodies. Jimmy Butler looks like he's playing hurt. Kyle Lowry is certainly playing hurt. Tyler Hero has missed the last two games with injuries, and the rest of the team is just kind of... you know, just falling apart. So it looks like Boston's going to close them out in six. And by my estimation, Boston's the best team, and they should win. But, you know, I don't think you ever count out Golden State just because of who they are and what they've accomplished.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure who I favor in that Golden State-Boston series, assuming it happens. That's interesting, because Boston is very erratic too.
Yeah,
and has been very erratic in this both season. And, Jason Tatum has had some games where he's absolutely a top five player in the world, and then he's had some games where he's been really terrible.
Yeah,
I mean, not just so-so, terrible.
Yeah,
and they're a little all over the place. And Jaylen Brown was very good last night, but he's got some issues sometimes too. He can't dribble.
That's a problem.
that's a little bit of an issue there, but so I don't know that. I think it's been fun. Yeah. I wish there would have been more close games.
Yeah. Oh boy, there've been a lot of bad games. Close. Yeah, you're right about that.
I think Boston and Golden State will be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I think it'll be a great series if it happens.
Maybe a Golden State will employ that strategy that you've been campaigning for so long. Maybe they'll press them full court.
Well, Steve Kerr is an innovator.
Well, in point of fact, I think he has coached a really good series against the Mavs by doing what you mentioned earlier, playing some zone. They've even played some box and one against Luka, which is like you never see NBA teams do that.
Yeah, I know. They have gone out. They've gone outside the box. That's a bad pun. Sorry about that. But they really have, and they're very conscious of stopping him with the ball.
Yeah.
And making it difficult for him to just go wherever he wants to, which he has been able to do as much as any player I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Previously in this playoff run.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Kerr gets a lot of credit. They get a lot of credit. And having a guy who can kind of sort of match up with Doncic in Wiggins, I think has been critical to it, but a lot of other things have gone into it too.
Yeah, I agree with that. You can definitely tell that Golden State has been around the block a few dozen times. you're not going to surprise them.
Yeah, that's right, and maybe that's their edge here.
Yeah, maybe so.
Because all four of these teams that are still playing, the other three are really have not been through this before.
Mm-hmm.
I guess you could argue Miami has to an extent, but really, and I think that's part of why they've been so erratic.
Mm-hmm.
The confidence is easily shaken, and maybe they have an edge. Golden State has an edge just in terms of pedigree or whatever, championship experience.
It could be. I mean, I just hope we have a good series, considering, as you mentioned, we've had so many poor games, so many one-sided games, you know?
Yeah, and games when neither team could shoot it, and wow, I don't know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm with you.
So I wanted to close on this. So this week, last Friday, Roger Angel, the great baseball writer, died at 101, and that coincides this weekend with the retirement of Ray Didinger, a longtime media great in the Philadelphia market at age 75. And there's been tributes and well-deserved tributes to both of them over these last several days. And I never crossed past a Roger Angel, save one time when this has had to be the early 80s. It had to be opening day too. And I was going to get my credential from a woman named Helen in the office at Memorial Stadium. That's how long ago it was. So I was there, you know. So I was like the third person in this little tableau, and all of a sudden Roger Angel walks in and he gives her his name to get his credential, and there was like suddenly this awe came upon her, which is well deserved.
She knew.
Yeah, she like as soon as he said his name, she was like, "Oh my God," you know, kind of like. So I'll never forget that scene.
I have been in the same press box as him a couple times at spring training, and I think at the 83 World Series. I think he was at the 83 World
Series.
Must have been. I remember I wouldn't have even known it was him except I saw his name on his credential, you know?
Right.
I didn't talk to him or anything like that. But, I mean, here's a guy who, a great writer, who just happened to write about baseball.
Right.
I mean, this guy's a great writer by any standard. Mm-hmm. Are a reader of the New Yorker, you've read his, and recently he's written some things just about what it's like to be 100 years old.
Correct.
More recently, he's written some of those things that have been really, really good. Just a pitch perfect stylist and storyteller.
Mm-hmm.
Just a great peer writer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in fact, one of the tributes that I was reading about him was, he didn't become a baseball writer until age 41, which is, you know, relatively late. so he kind of came at this from, I guess, a totally different perspective than somebody who, you know, came up through the ranks from this direction or that direction. And he just a really, as you mentioned, just a supreme stylist. The piece to which you refer, it's called This Old Man, which was written in 2014 and won a National Magazine Award for, essays, I think that was the category, but it was.
I can't believe that was eight years ago.
That's unbelievable. Yeah. Well, it's sad but true. Time seems to march on. I've noticed.
I've noticed that too. Well, the other thing about Roger Angel is, I can remember. The first thing that I remember with him was. Like the Red Sox and Reds World Series '75.
Yes.
I remember some of that stuff was so good.
Mm-hmm.
And he's one of those guys that, even when my understanding of writing was at a relatively immature stage, because I was an immature human being, I could tell that he had it. Yeah. I could tell that that was great writing, yeah.
Yeah, and he was blessed with something that nobody is blessed with anymore, and that was space and time. You know, he would.
Oh my God.
Yeah, he would really literally write these thousands and thousands of word pieces 6 weeks after the World Series had concluded. And
yeah, that's the other thing. Yeah, but there was no need for it to be timely. It was this evergreen thing. Although I must say, I still read the New Yorker. I still subscribe to the New Yorker. And their writers still have space and time.
Oh, my God. Do they ever.
I get in the middle of those, and I think, holy crap, I can't believe how long this is. You know, but even if it's really good stuff, you know. But anyway,
yeah.
I hear you.
So and I guess I heard Tom Verducci, he wrote about Roger. Actually, he wrote about him in 2014 when Roger took him to the graveyard where he would be buried, and the gravestone was there, and it had Roger's name on it with 1920 and then the dash, and all that needed to be filled in was...
Yeah, I remember that. I read that too. Yeah, yeah. I remember that.
So
yeah.
that was a great piece. And Verducci, who's sort of a spiritual successor to Roger, I would dare say.
Yeah, he's very, very good.
Yeah, he had a piece more recently just about his passing where he called up Roger's wife and she said basically Roger's last words were, what's the Mets score? That was almost literally his last words. So he was who he was to the end. So, I mean, that's yeah, quite a life. That is quite a life right
yeah.
there.
Yeah, there you go. So, over a century.
Yeah.
Well done.
Yeah.
R.I.P.
So, I guess he shares characteristics with Ray Dinger in that, you know, everybody wants to be first and everybody wants to be loudest in this day and age in media. But Ray was never that. He was always the most prepared guy in the room and always a true gentleman of sports. You know, a great NFL writer, 53 years in media. Between the Bulletin and the Daily News, and more recently on NBC Sports Philadelphia and on WIP as a sidekick for Glenn Mack now, and just a consummate professional all the way through. And I have crossed paths with him repeatedly, and he is exactly what he is on the air. He's just a thoroughly decent human being, and this is just a career. Yeah, you know, really unlike any other. To say, though, that Ray is a soft touch would be a mistake. He told me a story one time when he first started out covering the Eagles for the Bulletin. He's on a plane, you know, writers then travel with the team. And, you know, he's a very young man at that point. He's 75 now. And a tight end for the Eagles named Gary Ballman says, come on, what do you really know about football? So, you know, all the players are, you know, seated nearby and they're hearing this exchange. And Ray says, well, I know a bad football team when I see one.
Yeah. So. I always thought Ray had a great gig.
Yeah.
He loved the NFL. He loved the Eagles. And he got to, you know, comment on it. I mean, for a long time, it was a beat writer type of thing. But then it was, for a long, long time, it was just this sort of... he was an authority on the Eagles. He was a generally recognized authority on the Eagles and also was involved in the Pro Football Hall of Fame voting for a long time. And was in the writers' wing, inducted in the Pro Football Hall of Fame, by the way.
Yeah.
And another guy, we had Joe Giuliano on the show not too long ago, a gentleman. The first thing you think of is a gentleman.
Absolutely true. There's, I talked to Ray several years ago when I did a book with Pat Williams about the Sixers 82-83 championship team, and Ray was a columnist covering that team, and there were a couple pieces he did that season. The first one, they told him he had to that he was to write a feature about Moses Malone, so Moses wouldn't talk to him. Ray tried going through the team, he tried going through his agent, he tried going through everybody. Moses wasn't going to talk to him. Yeah, he even went on the road with him because somebody said, well, if you go on the road, you can probably get him. No, Moses wasn't going to talk to him. So, of course, Ray being Ray, he talked to everybody and wrote a really great piece. and which ended up winning a Keystone Press Award, not it should be noted. And the other, and the other piece that I remember from that season, the Sixers win it. They come back. They have this big celebration. They have a parade through the streets of Philadelphia, culminating in the Vet. And so Ray told me that he was driving to this parade. And he's like racking his brain about what he can write, what hasn't been written already about this team. So he finally decided that there was a play called That Championship Season, where the members of a high school basketball team gather 20 years later for their reunion. So he decided to go around and talk to various members of the team about what they think is going to happen to him 20 years later. And the best line of all was he talked to Mark McNamara about Moses, and he goes, 20 years from now, he'll still be leading the league in rebounding.
Didn't quite work out that way. Pretty close, but not.
Pretty close. So the other thing we should.
We never had Ray on the show.
I think we did, actually. I think we did.
I think we did too. Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
He was on talking. Yeah, he was on talking.
I'm certain that I have talked to him in this kind of a format somewhere. Yeah, whether it was a radio show or I think we did have him on.
Yeah, because he was talking about his book. He has a book out. It's his 12th book. We should also mention that he has a play called Tommy and Me, which is based on his youth when he grew up as a fan of Tommy McDonald and actually championed, speaking of the Hall of Fame, championed his Hall of Fame candidacy, which was successful. And that play will actually be presented in Hershey, later in August. Yeah. So that's interesting. So two real giants of the industry. We have one no longer with us and one retiring. So, R.I.P. to Roger Angel and all the best to Ray Dinger, one of the real gentlemen of our profession. So that's
absolutely.
So
couldn't agree more. Not like us.
as Sylvester Stallone, as Rocky said, we're just ham and eggers compared
that's
to these
exactly
guys.
Exactly right. That's exactly
right.
Which is not a bad thing.
Not a bad thing. So on that note, I guess we'll bid fond adieu for this week. So I'm Gordy, that's Mike, and we'll see you later.
See you later.